attention. I can't get no call to action, but I try and I try and I try.
Hello and welcome to Call to Action, the go-to podcast for anyone trying to make sense of the world of marketing, business, and beyond. In an industry that is a minefield of utter bollocks, we aim to capture our heroes and allies from the front line to have a chinwag with. It's like Pokemon Go, with the single but vital exception that it's not a short-term bandwagon of shite. It's brought to you by Gasp, and I'm Giles Edwards. This week, we hopefully hid hooligan hamsters hazardly in Harry Hill's Harrods hoodies, all to celebrate the alliterative awesomeness of our guests Harriet and Hannah, the heroic, humorous and heartingly human joint chiefs of Pablo. Having guided Pablo from their early days as a 30-person agency to two-time Global Campaign Indie of the Year, Harriet and Hannah have grown the agency in terms of people, revenue and a creative reputation that I'm only legally allowed to describe as bloody good. As well as making great work, they've turned Pablo into an agency everyone loves to work with, reeling in client after client while maintaining an unbelievable 100% retention rate. And while this is the part where a network agency would start slobbering over the profits and squeezing any margin that looks remotely squeezable, Harriet and Hannah used it as an opportunity to launch the Pablo Living Wage, which aims to increase the minimum salary in advertising to £30,000 and help make an advertising career more accessible and diverse. They say, "We're humble enough to know that if we ceased to exist tomorrow, nothing we've done would be remembered or pointed to in the future. That's what we're striving for here." Welcome to the show, Harriet and Hannah.
Oh, Giles, thank you. What an intro. I think that's the best intro I've ever had in my life. Thank you.
Double up as a copywriter. Can we get you in?
Yeah. Another one for the mums. 8 quick fires. Harriet, starting with you. Bath or London?
Bath.
Hannah, indie or network?
Indie.
Harriet, be distinct or be different?
Be distinct.
Hannah, humble or radical?
Humble.
Oh, easy. Harriet, we were going to ask favourite Pablos, but we've only got Picasso and Escobar, and I think they were notorious arseholes. So I'm going to go Hannah Montana or Hannah Penn.
Hannah Penn every single
there you go,
day.
There's a tap in. Hannah, garlic or lemon?
Garlic or lemon. I love his research. Absolutely garlic. Sorry to my husband.
Right, Harriet, Gordon Ramsay on a cow or foxes on a boat?
Foxes on a boat. It's my dad's favourite piece of work that I've ever not made.
Amazing. Best soundtrack too. And Hannah, lastly, Dick and Dom or Ant and Dec?
Ant and Dec? No way. How have you done that? Ant and Dec, yes.
That's so weird that came up before we started recording.
We literally chatted about Ant and Dec before the show, which I sound like an Ant and Dec obsessive now.
Yeah. What if I'd asked Ant or Dec?
Oh, Ant. He's come through some hard stuff, you know. Yeah, Ant.
You would have been a kids' TV presenter, I understand, from the research.
I would have done. My long-lost dream. That's what I always wanted
Amazing.
To be. Blue presenter, but then I found Harriet and she showed me a better way.
Well, if we can dig into that. So typically on the show, we ask our guests to describe their kind of career path to where they got to now and talk about their first ever jobs and then first ever like proper jobs. I appreciate we're going to be tighter on time because there's both of you and I don't want to do it a disservice. But Hannah, if we start with you, can you just give us an overview of what your early years looked like? First jobs, any aspirations you had to join the agency world?
Yeah, I mean, growing up, I did genuinely always want to be a kids' TV presenter, which was a dream that not come true. But I started sit in the way we all do, suddenly at 15, 16, going, I need to make some cash. My first ever job, I was the baker in my Marks and Spencers in my local town, which is a great job, actually, because all of the, well, maybe M&S won't appreciate me saying this, but it's taste delicious. All of the stuff's frozen. So you used to get the stuff out and bake it in the mornings. And if you slightly damaged a cookie, you couldn't serve it. So you'd have to eat it. So that also, only did I get the salary. I like basically just spent those 2 years really freeloading on mangy cookies and croissants that I'd accidentally broken.
Amazing.
And had those various jobs that we all have. And funnily enough, my first proper job was actually my last job because I was a grad on the AMV grad scheme for, and I worked there for 13 years. So I've only ever actually worked at two agencies, AMV for just over a decade, and then I left to join Pablo as MD. So yeah, when I reflect back, I just, what I did do that I would recommend so much to anybody trying to get into the industry is I hustled the heck out of work experience. I got really serious in my first and second year of studying and did loads and loads of different placements. I remember my first placement ever was at an agency called CCM Ping, which no longer exists. And I emailed them asking for work experience. And I remember somebody calling me going, why on earth do you want to do work experience here? And I just couldn't get any other doors open. And bless them, they like gave me a week. I think I was their first ever intern and I got hooked and then kept trying out some different agencies, which I would really recommend people do because it's great experience, shows your determination, but also there's nothing like learning on the job and just seeing it from the inside. Learned from some incredible people at AMV, had some real highs there, a really challenging COVID there, being honest. And then, yeah, after about 13, 14-ish years, was lucky enough to meet Gareth, Harriet and the Pablo team and join there where I've been for the last 4.5.
Amazing. Yeah, I think getting however you can is one of the few kind of common tips that we get from this part. And we're on episode 167, I think, now. And the reason forever, you know, asking this question to begin with when we first started the show was just because there's so much anxiety about there being a right way in. But it seems to be, you know, luck as much as any intent that leads people to this industry. You studied philosophy at Cambridge, which I wouldn't say is like the typical gate entry drug for advertising. At what stage did you think you wanted to get into the industry, or was there always that intent?
I got an early sense when I was in my first or second year that I did not want to go into pure business. And I knew that what really lit me up when I was around, I mean, ultimately philosophy is looking at different logical solutions, arguments, and forming opinions. And what I got really good at was that kind of analysis and breaking down data and insight and understanding how those things are built to convince people and persuade people of different perspectives. So funnily enough, I think the best thing about our industry, to your point, Giles, is there's no wrong or right way in. There are some of the obvious gateways, but there is nothing, in my opinion, that you could have done in a former life that doesn't make you relevant or qualified in our industry, because every experience is so, all our briefs are so varied and our clients are so varied and the people that we're speaking to are so varied that that diversity of experience is an excellent thing. So what I think philosophy gave me, very much by accident rather than design and intent, I didn't choose to study philosophy knowing that I wanted to go into advertising, but it gave me some fundamental basics that when, God love them, CCM Ping let me in for my week of work experience before they ceased to exist, I hope that was nothing to do with me, I started to go, oh wow, there's this really beautiful intersection here of proper business thinking and analysis with a creative output. And I think that's what bonds most people in our industry. We get off on the idea of putting something out into the world and being able to point to something and go, my thinking and my hard work helped to contribute towards that thing. And I, yeah, that spark was something that I felt the second I got experience and got quite hooked to.
Yeah, that's so well said. And I totally agree. I think that sadly, in many ways, that the time you are required to make those pivotal decisions as to further education and where you might end up and what you might study, most people are kind of blissfully unaware of the industry as an opportunity anyway.
Totally.
Harriet, can you share your background with us briefly?
Yeah, so aside from a very short-lived career as a paper girl delivering newspapers.
Okay, nice.
My first job was a Pizza Hut waitress, which I absolutely loved. And clearly Hannah and I were destined to be together because I equally loved the free food that I got at the end of every shift. And if you did a double shift, then you obviously got extra. End of every week, you had to clear out the ice cream factory and completely drain it. So I had a belly full of ice cream. But I think if I hadn't been working like 6 hours on my feet, running around, doing God knows how many steps, I might have felt a little bit more guilty for it. But no, it was definitely a well-deserved treat at the end of quite a long shift. But I actually loved working at Pizza Hut. It was brilliant. And actually, I still use a lot of what I learned there in my job now. You know, you've got to deal with customers and sometimes tricky customers, got to make sure people are happy, motivated. Back when I was growing up and I had my first job, there weren't the variety of restaurants that you have now. So literally on a Saturday night, people would come to either Pizza Hut or TGI Fridays. That's all that was available. And that was their date night. So you used to have queues out the door and had to manage all of that. And not least, I loved the fact that if you worked hard, you got tips, cash in hand, which you could use to go and spend at Topshop till your heart was content.
Topshop seems to come up a lot at the moment. I don't know why.
Well, it's no more, is it? It's so sad. No. But yeah, that's where Miss Selfridge or Topshop is where I spent all my money, really. Then my first proper job was actually working in M&A and investment banking, which you might go, how on earth did you end up in advertising? It must feel a world apart, but not dissimilar. And again, I use a lot of what I learned there in my day-to-day job now, not least the commercial side of it. As you get more and more senior, that becomes a bigger part of your job. And actually, they're not completely dissimilar. Like at the end of the day, as an investment bank, you're pitching for clients' business, whether that be to, you know, help them acquire a company, sell a company, merge, or whatever it might be, do an IPO. But you're solving their problems with financial solutions, not creative ones. And I think there was so much rigor around the process. It's a proper machine. I do take a lot of it into kind of what I do in my day-to-day job now. So it was a great experience, but I decided to leave it because, quite frankly, back also when I was working in the industry, I mean, I'm sure the hours are still pretty long now. There's actually a good BBC series on at the moment called Industry, which very much is reminiscent of being a graduate or an analyst in investment bank. But I basically love my friends and family too much to never see them. And you're working 20-hour days and, you know, you get paid a lot of money, but that they own you. And having weekends and things like that when you're going through your early 20s, you know, that's the time for living, right? You know, it's all well and good having a load of money, but you've got no time to spend it and no one to spend it with. It's just a bit depressing. So I left and found my way into advertising. And I guess you might ask, Giles, your question might be, how did I end up in advertising off the back of that? Well, I actually, when I was at school, I wanted to be a doctor. I did all my A-levels to be a doctor. So I did biology, chemistry, maths, and I did graphic design as well. I realised after doing some work experience at Heartlands Hospital in Birmingham that I didn't actually like blood that much. So that was a bit of an issue if I wanted to become a doctor. You know, I always loved problem solving and I loved helping people and things like that. But my brain has always been like science meets creativity, like those A-levels, biology, chemistry, maths, and graphic design. It's always been the fusion of those two things. And I think that's one of the things I did actually miss when I worked in investment banking. You haven't got as much creative outlet. In fact, if you're quite creative with numbers, it gets you into a lot of trouble more often than not. I actually, when I was working in the bank, I took some holiday and I did some work experience placements. I had a friend who worked in the industry and I'd always thought about marketing, but I didn't really know much about it. So I did a couple of work experience places, one of them at AMV, just before probably Hannah joined, M&C Saatchi and JWT. And I just loved it. I loved it so much. And I came back to the bank and I made the decision to resign. I remember still now, like, handing in my notice to my boss, and he was worried I was going to a competitor. And when I said I was leaving the industry and going somewhere else and told him where I wanted to go, he was like fully supportive of it. But I thought, no one's going to have me because my background's all finance. And I literally Googled top 50 advertising agencies and I applied to all of that. Hadn't long been, you know, I'd only been a couple of years at university. So I applied to all of their graduate schemes. I also, again, thought they wouldn't even look at my application for a graduate scheme because of my background. So I started looking at how I could be a receptionist or a PA and work my way up, you know, whatever way to get a foot in the door, as Hannah was talking about. And I was lucky enough, actually, I managed to get quite a few interviews and I got offered two jobs, one at JWT and one at Rainey Kelly. And I took the job at JWT and here I am now, over 20 years later, now at Pablo. I wouldn't have changed my pathway at all. I would do the same pathway all over again. Because like I said, I use so much of what I learned in the world of finance, investment banking and M&A in what I do now. But yeah, I think that piece we were just talking about a moment ago, determination, hustle, and, you know, a bit of luck, you know, definitely there was some luck on my side for sure. Any opportunity you've got to get experience and get exposure and show that you're really keen and hungry and curious, you know, if anything, it's a signal of that, not least, you know, giving you exposure to the industry and giving you a sense of what it's like before you potentially delve into it. Because it is a bit of an enigma. You know, you might have heard of marketing, but not many people have heard of advertising agencies and even know what we do, even if you have heard of them. So I think it's quite good just to get exposure to it and see where you might fit. You know, are you more of the creative, strategist, account person?
Yeah, amazing. I think firstly, I like that you've acknowledged that luck plays a role. I think that's true of all of us, but very few are, you know, keen to admit it, bizarrely. But I also, one observation I have, which is relevant to both of you, is I find that talking to other like small independent agency owners, it's amazing, and this is probably true in other categories and sectors too, but it's amazing how many people become good at the job, good at the thing, start a business that offers the thing, and then realizes there's so much they don't know about running a business. So actually, you coming in with your finance background was probably a huge advantage, but perhaps at the time it didn't feel like it would be, certainly for the role you're in now. I think one of the criticisms that can be fairly pointed at lots of marketing folk is how removed from the commercial world they can appear to be at times.
100%. People think it's a creative industry, so you don't need to know anything about numbers. Like, at the end of the day, we need to get paid in order to do the jobs that we do. So I think it's really, really important getting savvy about that. And also just understanding like how our clients make money, you know, and how they run their businesses. Because again, as you get more and more senior, you need to become a partner in your client's business and really, you know, become an ally or a wing woman or a wing man to them. And part of that is getting your head around like how a business operates.
It's quite a big evolution that we've seen, isn't it, has in when we were growing up through big holding company agencies. There was a belief that was, I don't doubt, the right thing at the time, that 100% of the account lead's job was to foster a relationship, and commercial conversations can be sources of stress and strain in a relationship. So Haz and I have worked in agencies where the entire commercial responsibility is outsourced to a commercial team to basically liberate, was the perspective. And it did work back in the, I mean, we're not that old, but you know, your late 90s, early noughties. How do you just make it so that all that we're talking about is beautiful creative products and endeavor, and anything that might be a bit fractious in the relationship when it comes to commerciality is dealt with over there and doesn't kind of pollute the center? It doesn't help people become proper, well-branded business brains. And what Harriet has always strived to do for her background, and what we've really baked into Pablo as a result, is you don't want to infantilize people to not be able to lean into those conversations with clients. And they're not fractious conversations. They're conversations about the healthy running of their business and our business, so we can be great partners together. And the more comfortable and the more you flex that muscle, it's not something that is beyond anybody. It's often just about knowing that you are empowered and feel confident to step into that space. And I think the more the agency people can do that, to your point, Giles, to build that credibility, the better.
Yeah, that's such a good point, Hannah. I think you used the word, it was to liberate them, but you know, it clearly probably blinded some of them to the realities that you operate in, right? And that kind of good cop, bad cop dynamic that they were trying to create is, I suppose, in some instances helpful, but in many, not so helpful. One thing we've always encouraged of our team here is to bring up commercials as soon as possible in the conversation, because it just normalizes it and feels more like a grown-up conversation to have. I do want to get on to how you guys met, incidentally. I'm jumping in a little bit here. But do you think it's hard to demonstrate creative or commercial creativity or applied creativity, whichever term we want to use? And at what stage of your careers did you start to kind of truly understand that?
I was really spoiled at AMD, thanks to the brilliant then strategic heads of Craig Maudsley and Bridget Anger, who just, it's what they, you had it absolutely drummed into you. And as a grad at AMV, at the time that I came through, the Sainsbury's Try Something New Today case study had just, we just repitched for the business, won it, and the Try Something New. And everybody knew that business problem was, how do you grow the business? I can still parrot it at you now, by getting every customer to spend £1.40 more. If we get every customer to spend £1.40 more, we will hit our growth targets. So the whole campaign came, how do you get everybody to just up their basket size by that amount? That taught me, from just stepping into an ad agency from the word go, you are rudderless if you don't know on the tip of your tongue what you are trying to do for a brand and how you'll know when you've done it. And I think often there are all these acronyms, you know, the KPIs, the performance metric. You've got to you've got to get comfortable having conversations that a lot of people find not uncomfortable, but challenging, because lots of marketeers aren't necessarily given the information they need from their businesses to be really clear on that. So being able to partner with them to go, what are we trying to do here? How does marketing serve the business? And how are we going to be able to show people when we've done it? And at Pablo, Harriet and I have the most incredible strategy team headed up by Mark Sung and Lisa Stoney, and they are effectiveness junkies. And that's been a big part of our development, I would say, as a business, hasn't it, over the last 2 or 3 years, which is, yes, we can, winning new business is one thing, and it's a wonderful, wild ride. You don't keep winning new business unless you can show what you've yielded for those companies 2-3 years down the line of working together. So we've got really intentional around investing in that and being able to tell effectiveness stories, which I think excite me personally even more than the big creative ones. Being able to show what excellent creativity has done for a business is where our industry comes alive.
Now more than ever, to be honest, because, you know, cost of living crisis, recessions we've, you know, lent into and things like that, the first thing that often gets cut is the marketing budget. And a lot of the results you sometimes get are softer metrics. So actually showing the ROI, showing, you know, how much extra money it brought into the UK economy through the work we do with the International Great Campaign, those things are incredibly important. You know, they always have been, but now more than ever, to help ensure that people understand the true value of marketing and what it really can deliver for a business. Time, weather, and
always. We interrupt this podcast to announce that we will never interrupt this podcast with ads. Ads that awkwardly nudge you to contact the pod's host, Giles Edwards. Only last week, some pod listening companies did just that, calling for guidance on proper marketing. But we're not asking you to do that. Nope. Anyway, back to the show.
Marketing is incredibly confused with sales.
I think you're the one who's more confused, Gary V, Sunshine. Here we go.
How did you guys first cross paths then? And then how do you go from crossing paths to the duo that I have before me today?
The weirdest thing for Haz and I now, having worked hand in glove for 5 years, is that we've never met. And we often say, how the hell had we not met? Our paths didn't accidentally cross. They very intentionally crossed thanks to Gareth, our founder, who obviously knew and had been working with Harriet and then met me. It was just after Christmas that I started conversations with Gareth. And then he said, look, the clincher for this is going to be if Harriet thinks you're good. So it was in the middle of COVID. So we couldn't do anything normal. So we basically met. In hindsight, it was desperately romantic knowing what came next, but we met on the Thames to go for a river walk. And it was this slightly crazy, you've got 90 minutes together to figure out if you think you could, you know, run a business with the Habo management team together. And we often say it was like the best of first dates because there was just no room for small talk. It was like straight into the fundamentals of like, who are you as a person? What motivates you? What excites you? Where do you think the opportunities are? And like proper existential, like, what do you want to have achieved in 5 years? Because you've got to make sure if you're going to do it together, you're aligned on the fundamentals. That would be your biggest advice to people. And we can talk about the fact that it isn't common outside of creative couplets to have duos in advertising. And we don't know why, because we just think it's all upside. Yeah, we just had this brilliant experience of let's figure out, do our values match? And I don't mean that in a you know, philosophical nonsense way. I mean it in a, like, are we motivated by the same things? Do we see the same opportunities here? Do we complement each other and have a good yin and yang? And I think you can have those conversations whether or not you've clearly got a partnership agreement with somebody. You can have it with the groups around you. It's a really healthy conversation to have with the people that you work with. And yeah, I mean, after 90 minutes, it was just so, I mean, we just absolutely spin the yarns, didn't we, Haz? And it just was from the moment we met. And like I say, it was very intentional and it was very much Gareth that put us together. But we can really see why. And it's been an absolute joy from that first meeting. And there have been amazing highs that you've really kindly talked about. Some really hard days. Of course there are. There were really hard days. And the thing with getting to do it with somebody is that the highs are higher and the lows are never lonely. So it's just a real privilege to have a partner to do it with. It was basically Joel's like an arranged marriage.
Yeah.
By being frank. Yeah, and we met up and, you know, I'd heard so many great things about Hannah, and Hannah knew some of my friends or people I'd worked with in the past, but I hadn't realised how much we were literally going to click. It was like we were always meant to meet. I know that sounds so cheesy and corny, but I can't imagine doing this job without Hannah now. And quite frankly, I wouldn't want to. I get so much more enjoyment out of it and fulfillment. And I think I was at Pablo before Hannah, so I've been here for 7 years now. And I was in a head of account management role before. But it was a big step up, stepping up to MD. And albeit, you know, as with any promotion, you've got to be doing that job a bit before you take the promotion on, so you're not out of your depth. There was, of course, a little bit of imposter syndrome. And I think there was something really nice about having someone to do it with, make mistakes with, grow, learn from, you know, do it together, build together. And I think that's what also really excited me. You know, when I met Hannah, I was like, God, there is so much I can learn from this woman. You know, I feel like we could be a perfect partnership and wing women to each other and build each other up and really fuel each other's momentum, which is the experience I've had totally.
What's really interesting to me is you actually pointed out initially that beyond creative teams, you rarely get things happening in pairs in terms of the positions within agency world. And I've heard a quote from you saying, it's not like one of us does one thing, someone does the people, someone does the numbers. However, with creative teams, admittedly, there's more hybrid creatives than perhaps there once was, but you tend to have an even split of art and copy. So how does it practically work if you're not creating a clean split? There's got to be some kind of, I mean, who's good cop, who's bad cop? It's got to be some kind of sway, right?
I actually don't know the answer to that, Hannah. Maybe, I don't know if you could ask it. You have to ask some people in the agency.
Yeah, like maybe in different scenarios, maybe like in certain subject matter, I'm the bad cop. Certain subject matter, Hannah's the bad cop. But I mean, when it comes to carving out the role, it's completely intuitive, really. Obviously, as Hannah said, you've got to be really aligned on the big picture, the vision, but you naturally jump into the parts which are better suited to your individual skill sets. And then, of course, you know, make sure you're getting exposure to the areas where you maybe have less experience in to ensure that you keep growing there and you can learn from each other. So, I guess sometimes, probably because of my background, I lean a bit more into the numbers. Hannah does loads of numbers, but sometimes maybe I over-index in that sometimes. Sometimes Hannah leads more into the kind of people side of the business, development. Hannah's an incredible front woman. I don't know if you've seen her recently being interviewed on BBC News about a project, which hopefully we'll get a chance to touch upon later. But like, you know, it's like she's been media trained and she hasn't. So she leans into a lot of those sorts of things, maybe more so than I do. That's the beauty of it. We've got complementary skill sets. And I think when they fuse together, they create something quite powerful. And, you know, we like learning from each other in different spaces. And I think that's the thing about the best leaders, right? They surround themselves with people who are better than them. And I think Hannah and I both know what each other's superpowers are and really proud about, you know, each other's respectively, and we know how we complement each other. And I think that's what we kind of lean into. It's never a competitive situation. And, you know, you've got to keep ensuring that you're over-communicating with each other as a two as well, because if you're sometimes dividing and conquering on things as well, you need to make sure that you're still running in the trenches together and you know, one of you doesn't fall behind or miss something. But I think we've got into a really good rhythm of doing that. If anything, I think we probably over communicate, but I think that's probably part of our secret sauce.
Yeah, no, it sounds fantastic. And I think the, you know, success is testament to how well it works between the two of you. I mean, in the introduction, I nodded to the 2-time Global Campaign Indie of the Year. And yet the reason why I chose the quote that we did is it kind of clashes with the, you know, the idea of leaving a legacy. I think to many people out there, that would be legacy enough. So can you talk a bit about that ambition? Because I know there's all sorts of initiatives. I've mentioned the Pablo Living Wage. There's the UVUC and the Higher VizVest, which I adore. Is that what you mean when you hint at legacy?
We've all had different experiences in the industry, haven't we? And I think Harriet and I had different journeys through the beginning of COVID. And I hold on to that experience quite keenly because I learned a lot through how hard that was. And I guess the reason why it's felt relevant so relevant for me personally is because we are an industry that trades very publicly as a sector on people and culture. And what I think a lot of us saw in COVID was a blunt reality that when stuff gets hard out of a business's control, I was in a business at that point that did not have the ability to pivot and make the decisions that it needed. So I was in this really challenging reality of being at the cold face of having a lot of people looking to me for reassurance and stability with absolutely no ability to pull any levers to make that happen because everything was being dictated to me by a holding company. That was part of the unbelievable attraction when I met the management team at Pablo, because I remember really naively one of my questions to Gareth and Harriet being, you know, how have you found the redundancy process? Like, are you through it? Because I don't know psychologically if I can keep going back into those. Like, I need you to be honest with me of where you are in your journey. And they went, I don't know what you're talking about. We haven't made a single redundancy at Pablo. And it was like this light bulb going on in my head of going, people that had to make redundancies in COVID did not do so other than because they absolutely felt they had to, but it made me realize that there was a different way and a different ability to genuinely control the fundamentals of your business in a way that was right by your people. And I think that is a privilege that Harriet, myself, and the rest of the management team at Pablo, we know that we have. Like, we can, as an organization, make decisions and make changes that move our industry forward with very little pain compared to other organizations. And of course, there are commercial realities to those decisions, but it's a joy and it's an absolute privilege that that's the only repercussion. There is no red tape. It is just about seven people sitting around a table going, what do we think is the right thing to do here? So I think that's where the legacy piece really starts to play in, where we've all, you know, we've got the life that we've got on this planet and we've got the time that we've got. And I think a lot of people, Haz will speak to this, I'm sure, as well. You go through your career and you see a lot of people drop out of advertising because they don't feel like it is a purposeful endeavor. And some people are quite judgmental about it ethically as an industry. I remember having a mentoring session with an amazing marketer called Peter Duffy, who was at EasyJet at the time. And it was through the Marketing Academy, which is an incredible training program that Harriet has also been on as well. And I remember I was deputy head of account management at AMV at the time, and I just had my third resignation in like a couple of months of a superstar saying, I need to go out and do something really purposeful and cause-based, and I can't do that in advertising. And I was really struggling with how to represent the sector to brilliant people. And Peter had a really big impression on me at the time because he said, there is so much pride that we should have in the marketing and advertising sector because we provide jobs and we provide services and we prop up the economy and we can deliver within our corner of the world brilliant experiences for everybody that works with us. And when you're at that point, Peter Duffy would have had hundreds, thousands of employees in his organization. Harriet and I are lucky enough now that we've gone from 30, we've got 120 people that we can have a direct impact on and then can try to have a halo with the rest of the agency across the industry at large. And what an amazing kind of opportunity is that to think about not just how we get to brilliant work and getting to brilliant work, but doing so in a way that moves the industry and moves standards forward. So I think that's what it's kind of all about for us. It's having maybe have had some challenging chapters elsewhere and also working with a management team who all really share this ambition. And, you know, founders like Gareth, he's not worked in conventional advertising agencies. So he goes, well, why should it be like that? It can be like this, and encourages everybody in the organization to think like that. So it's a real open invitation to move things forward in the work we make and the way that we go about doing it.
When we won the first time, Agency of the Year, UK and Global Agency of the Year, we all went out as a management team just to kind of talk about like the journey we'd been on and like what our highs were over, you know, what we're really proud of. And one of our creative partners, Tim Snape, he's the one who said that quote around like look really proud of what we've done and never thought I'd ever see Pablo kind of getting here. But if we disappeared tomorrow, you know, what is our legacy? You know, what would people remember us for? And it always stuck with Hannah and I for all the reasons Hannah's just spoken to. It was just, it really, really kind of stuck in our mind. And I think for us, when we talk about legacy, it needs to be something that genuinely pushes the industry on and makes it a better place to work, but also something that genuinely makes the lives of people, whether that be people within the industry or outside of it, like consumers, better. And that is the big reason why definitely I came to Pablo, and I know it's the same for Hannah. Like, we wanted to come somewhere and actually have an impact. You know, we had brilliant backdrop of experience and a brilliant training ground at all the agencies we've been at before, which I wouldn't trade, you know, for anything. But we wanted to channel that into really having an impact and doing something. And I think for us, we explore it on two levels. We explore it either through creative work, you know, something that's really going to have an impact. And we actually put our own money behind causes or initiatives that really can use our creativity as a force for good. And I think you mentioned a couple of them a moment ago, Giles. Like, we very much kind of doubled down on this actually in the pandemic to start with. And then it's just kind of gathered momentum. And one of the most recent ones is UVUC, which is tackling melanoma in the construction trade, which I'm sure Hannah can talk to much more because that's her baby, having come from some of her own personal experiences. You know, but we did everything from, for all those football fans out there, in the previous Euros where Christian Eriksen, the Danish player, had a cardiac arrest on the pitch, really wanted to do something to get that vital life-saving skill of CPR into the hands of the nation. You know, we're one of the few countries where it's not taught at school. And in countries where it is taught at school, the survival rate from a cardiac arrest is like astronomically higher. So one of the things we did was create a new range of CPR mannequins in the image of kind of popular culture people, idols that young people would look up to and genuinely want to practice on and genuinely want to learn and save. So the first was like Connor Swindles, who's been in Barbie movie, SAS, Sex Education, right through to when we're in the beginning of the pandemic, when we couldn't go anywhere. The nation's, well, the world's mental health was suffering because people couldn't get that respite that they needed from going on holiday. We actually created a series of like 360 binaural sound escapes called Sonic Escapes, which I don't know how much you know about like 360 sound. It's basically how your ears hear sound in the real world rather than in stereo, which is kind of a little bit more one-dimensional. We created escapes to Jamaica, Mexico, Morocco, allow people literally to listen 15 minutes, plug away and transport their minds to places their bodies couldn't go, right through to the recent work that we've done with UVUC. But I think we do a lot around that space. And I think the second thing, which is really, really important and a passion project for Hannah and I, is beyond our creative work, it's how can we walk the walk with our own Pablo brand? So we actually made a commitment to ourselves to every year introduce at least one industry-leading policy to challenge the status quo, make the industry more equitable, more inclusive, especially for underrepresented groups. And I think we're very much an agency which is all about action. Like, you know, we talk about that a lot to our clients. You know, brands today are defined just as much by what they do and what they demonstrate, not by what they're just saying in their adverts. And I think we live that for ourselves very much. And I think one of the spaces where there is a lot of talk and not much action is DE&I. So we started on that journey a couple of years ago where we were the first agency to introduce a gender-neutral parental leave policy. You mentioned the Pablo Living Wage, which is the first agency to introduce a new minimum salary of 30K to the industry. And we've since seen six other agencies follow suit. We've got something in the works, which is really exciting, around carers. So I think for us, that's really, really important. So I guess that legacy is on a twofold level. But I think the premise of it all is about really making the lives of people better and also making this industry one which really unlocks its full potential and opens it up.
Yeah, that's fantastic. And it's so nice that you're able to have freedom. Is probably not the right word to use, because you need to afford your own freedom in order to be doing these wonderful initiatives, don't you? The actual agency side of the business, but they are obviously all part of the same entity.
Well, we're independent, so I think that helps.
Exactly. Yeah.
Like, I remember when we launched the Pablo Living Wage, the other six agencies I've mentioned, it's not a coincidence. They're all independents. And I think, look, we have that in our gift, right? We're not beholden to a big holding company or something like that. And obviously they have much bigger talent bases and, you know, bigger overheads and, you know, tighter margin control. We were really fortunate enough to come off the back of a year of really good new business. I think we won something like 17 new clients. And as Hannah mentioned earlier, you know, we are nothing without our people. We're a people-based business. They're our most valuable asset. So at the start of the year, coming off a really strong year, when we spoke as a management team about what we wanted to invest in and where those investment priorities should be, for us, it was our people. And I think there is a real problem in this industry, especially with young talent. You know, the last decade, we've been leaking talent to various other industries, consultancy, tech, you know, offering much more sustainable salaries. The starting salary in our industry had been the same when Hannah and I started. It hardly gone up. You know, it actually represents a decrease when you add in inflation and things like that. So we were like, if we have that within our gift to do and really invest and try and help fuel and support the next generation of leaders, then it's a no-brainer for us. But we also appreciate not everyone's going to be in the same circumstance and have that opportunity to make that sort of decision.
I think what you're doing is wonderful. And hearing you both talk about it is not only inspiring, but it's really reassuring from one indie agency to another to hear your focus and to hear that purpose that drives the business. So huge respect to you both. I mentioned before recording that we've got a number of listener questions. And I think if we move to that now, we should be able to squeeze a few in. So asking the general public for their opinion, be it on Brexit or boat names, is notoriously fraught with danger. Dan asks, agencies naturally talk a great game about culture. What does culture mean to them and how do they think about it?
Hannah and I have a little kind of ambition or mission statement for ourselves, which is we want people to come to Pabla and make the work of their lives, having the time of their lives. I'm a great believer, having worked in another industry as well, like this should be one of the most fun jobs and industries on the planet. You're dealing with creative ideas. And I think that's what's really important for us in terms of, there's loads of things you could say about culture, but I think we try and create a culture or an environment where people can have fun, enjoy themselves. You know, they're ambitious and, you know, of course, you know, give it their all, but also have got the freedom to make decisions like we've just spoken about, to do things which deliver on Pablo's bigger mission of making the lives of people better. But also they do it without being burdened with some of the other kind of worries or concerns or baggage that you might have elsewhere. And again, that was one of the other reasons why we did something like the Pablo Living Wage, because creativity does not flourish when you are stressed about, are you going to have enough money to feed yourself at the end of the week or pay your rent or something? Creative minds don't flourish when they are burdened with stuff like a mental load like that. So I think that's kind of a bit of a guiding star for us in terms of the sort of culture and environment we want to create. And I guess, you know, for me and Hannah, we see our job as creating an environment where people really can flourish and be themselves, bring their whole selves to work and, you know, really enjoy it in the process. So that's probably not the conventional answer to a question on what does culture mean to you. But I guess, you know, for me, it's about creating that environment and that space where people really can be who they are and have fun doing it.
I totally agree with that, my love. And I think the thing that is, my perception on culture has really changed from being a young'un in the industry to now a managing director of an agency, because I think the key thing and what Harriet said is that cultures thrive when everybody's able to contribute to them. And I think my fear on taking on this role, I work a 4-day week, I've got two kids. I knew that I was never going to be able to be the MD that I had coming through the ranks, because the MDs, and my God, they were amazing. But what I saw of a really excellent MD was somebody that was at the pub, card behind the bar, kind of basically like the agency host, like literally being the culture and bringing the culture. And I think that our industry has really changed in the last decade. And I don't think people, not only am I not that, I don't drink and I'm a mum. So like, I want to be home by 5:30 to put my kids' meals on the table and put them to bed. Like that's my balance in life. And has is exactly the same. Like we've got priorities outside of work that mean that we're not trying to mandate culture on people. And it's meant that our agency is very much about people that want, to Harriet's point, to put their DNA into something and to feel like it's more than just a job and it's a reflection a bit of who they are. And when everybody brings a little bit of that to a place, that's the culture. So yeah, I guess it's a slightly high philosophical way of answering the question. But what I have really seen is that within a parameter of going, who are we as a group and what do we identify as that makes us proud? I think you have to set that so that people are clear on who you're hiring and why you're hiring them and what you're wanting them to help you achieve when they're there. Outside of that, you've just got to let people fill and color in and who they, and that is really what a culture is about. It's not top down anymore. It's all about everybody in the organization feeling like that space, they're proud that it reflects something about who they want to be in the world every day.
Yeah, brilliant. Well said. Dan actually snuck in an extra question and he said, how do you separate the important stuff from the relentless industry noise? Not quite sure which relentless industry noise he's referring to, but there is certainly a lot of it.
Do you know what? I would quickly say two things on that. A really good tip that somebody gave me is when you're sitting down to do something, ask yourself, could somebody else do this? And is there something else that I should be doing that nobody else is thinking about? That's quite a good 2-minute exercise to force yourself to identify the stuff that's a bit scary that you're ignoring, because there's something that feels familiar that you can do more quickly. There is noise that you can get stuck within. There is a book that I would really recommend to people that has just kind of changed my life. I had a great conversation with one of our amazing strats, Chris Turner, recently, who had read another one of Oliver's books. The book that I've just read is called 4,000 Weeks, and it's all about, terrifyingly, 4,000 weeks is the average lifespan of a human being, which when you say it like that sounds really short. And it's basically about the trap of modern productivity and how we have convinced ourselves that we can get more control over things and we therefore get really caught up in the noise. And actually, the book, which I can give you in a Spark Notes version in case people don't have time to read anymore, what it helps you to identify is that we are our own worst enemies here, because I have a bit of an obsession with trying to keep on top of my inbox because I like the idea of me feeling in control and me looking responsive. Actually, what the book has helped me to realize is that I'm perpetuating the problem, because the better you are at responding to emails and the more emails you send out, the more you get back. So actually, I think there is something that we can all feel a bit victim to noise, but ask yourself the question of, are you doing something that somebody else could do? And what's the thing that nobody is doing that you should therefore be thinking about? And that is true of whatever level you are in any organization. And also take accountability for the noise that you're creating for yourself, because you can only really control what's within your control. And being mindful of the ripples that you're creating that are causing yourself pain, I think is actually quite an important and empowering tool.
Yeah, amazing. Hannah, that's the second time you've, first it was Anson Deck, now it's the 4,000 weeks. I mentioned to Harriet before recording, it was my daughter's last day at their school today, and they had their kind of speech day award ceremony, and the school had got in a guest speaker who's the UK's first doctor of happiness. I won't lie, I was quite cynical of that until I heard him speak, and he was amazing. But something that was central to his talk was that 4,000 week stat, and it was amazing how differently the children reacted to the adults and the grandparents in the room.
Who's the doctor of happiness?
Oh no, I knew you'd ask that. I'll find out and I'll put it in the show's notes and I'll email it to you, because the name escapes me now.
I love that your reaction is cynicism and mine was doctor of happiness.
But you would love that job, Hannah, because you are a little bundle of happiness and joy. Like, you're always smiling. If you can't find a picture of Hannah not smiling.
Amazing. That's why she's destined for CBeebies.
Exactly. Anybody's listening.
Oh, dear. Amazing. I've got a creative question here from Charlie. So we'll probably need to rope in a few other people from your team to answer this, but we'll give it a go. Charlie says, the track used for the Peretti ad, was that a song you'd always wanted to use and it made sense? Or was it a discovery made as part of the research?
It's so funny. That is an amazing question, because we actually did a whole talk to our agency on
the track from that ad. And that the ad was created by a wonderful team called Charlie and David. And David Shirley did a presentation to our business on basically what a curious creative mind looks like and how to constantly cultivate creative inspiration in your life. And funnily enough, that track was a track that he'd heard a decade before. And what David does as a behavior that everybody should steal with pride, and this is very much not my advice, it's David's, and he's a wonderful, wonderful creative human being, is he basically creates like his own creative Pinterest boards in his mind on his phone, where he is constantly, whenever he sees something, either, you know, listening to a track, seeing a certain art installation, even like, you know, looking at something down your local shop that you feel has been created in an interesting way, finding a format that works for you to store that. That track had been something that was in the back of his mind from literally a decade before, that he'd heard on like a night out on a holiday. And he wrote the ad with that track in mind and basically went back through his vault of inspiration and went, this is what I'm going to write to. And so it was very much a hand in glove of the execution being developed with that track in mind, because he is somebody that is fastidious enough and considered enough to go, every day is a school day, and whenever you're out in the world, you're going to see things that inspire you, and being intentional about clocking those and saving them up, even if it's a decade later, as it ended up being for wonderful Charlie and David. That track is such an essential part of what has made that campaign so successful, and it's because he was really intentional about cultivating it.
We almost had to pivot at the last minute to change it, because EasyJet, I think it's EasyJet, Hannah, isn't it, launched.
Yes, it is. Yeah, they did
a campaign with the same track. We were like, oh my God. So after over a decade of David keeping it in his locker, in his bottom drawer to use, it then got used. And I think the team were like, oh God, is it, you know, all going to be too close? Should we look at something else? And they did look at lots of other options, and they just kept coming back to that track because it was so integral to the DNA of what we created, and just thought, fuck it, let's just go for it. And I don't think it's done any disservice. I mean, they're in very different categories, and I think I can't imagine that campaign without that track on it now.
I think, correct me if I'm wrong, but I've loved that track for years, but I remember the original story. Was it not an Italian singer who wanted to prove he could have a hit record?
Yes.
Just by sounding English,
I mean,
even though it's like gibberish.
Perfect for
so good.
The Italian vibe and philosophy that's coming through on that. So, yeah.
Right, Eve asks, oh, let's just go with the silly question. You've won another Indie Agency of the Year trophy. Who gets to take it home?
Well, actually, Hannah and I didn't take it home. Gareth took it home, our founder. I think he's still got it at his. And actually, well, that's the global one. The UK ones, I did actually take them home, but then only to look after them and then take them into the office. They're all sitting pride of place in our new office in Farringdon.
Fantastic. We'll move to our final four pertinent poses. We can alternate these, or if you've got something to chip in, feel free to add. So they start, number one, what advice would you give to your younger self? Do you want to kick that off, Hannah?
I thought it was my job to make problems go away really quickly and to keep everything really smooth. And I would have quite a lot of anxiety when challenge would come in a creative process. What I have learned is that challenge and problems are the thing that keeps you employed. Because if it's all easy, and if nothing ever goes wrong, or if there is never, you know, from the genesis of what's in the brief, what's the problem facing the brand, all the way through to the inevitable challenges that come through a creative process, you can't justify a living if it's all easy and everything's going great. So it was Cilla Snowball at AMV who I learned so much from, but learn to love your problems and do not feel the responsibility on your shoulders of solving them. Just know that it's your job to understand and identify them and then bring people around them to help you with them. I think I would have saved myself a lot of unnecessary anxiety and stress in my early years if I'd have learned that sooner.
It's Dr. Andy Cope, by the way. His name's just popped into my head because I was about to reference another story he shared, and something he's actively doing to try and remain a bit more positive than I suppose people are by default, is that kind of eye roll that we tend to do when you come up to a red light or there's a traffic jam and you have that very British, why is this always happening to me mentality. He started to reverse it in his life. So if the train arrives on time, he rolls his eyes and say, oh, why does this always happen to me? Or if there's no traffic on the road, or we get somewhere on time, or, you know, every evening, where he says, oh, why does it always happen to me? I have a lovely dinner with my family every evening. And he's consciously making an effort to kind of notice all of the positivity in our life that we kind of take for granted.
That's nice.
Yeah, it's lovely. Have you got anything to add to that, Harriet?
Mine, I think, would be take a risk and don't be afraid to rip up the rule book. So I mentioned at the start of this that I started my working life in investment banking. I soon realized that wasn't going to be a lifelong career. So despite being an incredibly risk-averse person, I decided to leave the world of investment banking, taking a massive salary cut, like 3/4 of my salary, to go into the world of advertising. And ever since that moment, despite being quite risk averse, when it comes to my career, I've always seen change as a really good thing. Like, I started at JBT, I left JBT to go to another 30, 40 person agency called Karmarama. Then when I left Karmarama, I went to Ogilvy, which had a brand new management team, like, you know, going through a hell of a lot of change itself. And I've always found I've benefited from taking those risks and jumping into places where there is change going on. You know, it's something that pushes you outside your comfort zone. It's something that propels you forward at a rate of knots. So that would be my advice to myself. Don't be so worried and anxious about change. It's good, especially when it comes to your career.
Yeah, brilliant. That's great advice. If you could banish one thing from the industry, what would it be and why?
Email. I'm going to sound like an absolute Luddite, but off the back of reading 4,000 Weeks, I started to read a book about the impact of email on human development. And some of the statistics, when you're forced to face them, are quite terrifying. In recent studies, we go an average of 6 minutes in creative industries between checking emails in meetings and when in other tasks. You just can't do deep, thoughtful work with that level of distraction. I don't think us working at the speed that email allows us to makes for a better product. I think now we're having to focus our efforts on trying to remove the distraction. So yeah, there's almost nothing that we don't believe is better solved with a phone call or a face-to-face cup of tea. And email is really, I think, something that has got our industry under way too much. It's got way too much power over our industry. And I think finding a way out of that trap would be a liberating joy.
Amazing, amazing. That's so well put. There's almost kind of a productivity delusion around emails, right?
There really is. There really is. And it invariably, none of the really, really important business challenge is solved on an email. At no point. At no point is anything that is fundamental originated through an email.
Totally agree. Look, we're in a people-based industry, and I think the pandemic didn't help any of that, because we got increasingly remote, more in this transactional world of emails, Zoom calls, and all of these sorts of things. But you've got to remember, at the end of the day, we're all human beings, clients, partners, you know, everyone within the agency, and nothing's better than a conversation. The amount of things I've seen go back and forth over email, which literally, as soon as someone's picked up the phone and had a 2-minute conversation, have been diffused. And, you know, that would have got them to the answer much, much quicker. Is phenomenal. So yeah, and we keep having to remind, especially some of the youngsters, because they've grown up in that world. It's just, especially things like WhatsApp and stuff, like, guys, just go and talk to that person who's sitting opposite you rather than WhatsApp them something. Like, it's just, it'll be much more effective and much better use of your time.
Yeah, well said. Well said. Same with phone calls, right? I have to WhatsApp members of my team if I'm going to then need to have a phone conversation with them. Otherwise, they don't pick up.
Oh, yeah.
Maybe could just be a lack of respect for me.
There's a bit of anxiety around it, I think, because they're so used to doing stuff over, like, faceless things like email, WhatsApp. When you actually get someone on the phone, I think that sometimes I think people are a bit nervous.
Yeah, no, true.
Whereas I love it. Like, I think you can, especially a phone call versus a video call, you can break down so many more barriers. And you can actually, there's something about not seeing someone, which I think you can be a bit more candid and just lay it all out.
Yeah, for sure. We've touched on one already, Hannah has, but Harriet, are there any books that you would recommend? And then Hannah, if you want to add to the load, that would be ace.
Hannah's more of the marketing comms psychology nerd.
We take fiction as well.
Yeah, I've got loads of fiction recommendations. To be honest, I'd love to read books more than I do. I only really read them when I'm on holiday. But if I was going to recommend a book, it's not actually a fiction. It's called Cork Dork by Bianca Bosca. I have a little side hustle or passion in wine. I love drinking it, but not it's not what you think it is when I say passionate about wine. Actually, in the pandemic, I did a couple of wine qualifications. I was fed up with going to supermarket or restaurant and ordering the same thing or not knowing what I liked and why I liked it. And a friend had done this course called Wine and Spirits Education Trust Level 2 and later did Level 3. And she was like, I think you'd love it. And I did. I did Level 2 and loved it so much I did Level 3. But Cork Dork is basically a journalist who used to be a tech journalist, Bianca Bosca, who gave up her job and actually went on a journey to train up to be a sommelier and take a similar qualification to what I have. And as a journalist, she's obviously written a book about her experiences. So she's done everything from working as a, it's called a cellarat in a restaurant, like bringing up the wine bottles, to going to interview the scientists who make the likes of like Blossom Hill, to speaking to a doctor who deals with the olfactory system. It's a really good like dinner table book, to be honest. Like, some really good facts and stats in it. It's a good little eye-opener if you just want to learn a little bit more about that.
Nice. Awesome. It's a great title as well. Cork Dork. Hannah, are you going to throw any more in?
Definitely read 4,000 Weeks. The other one that was recommended to me by Chris Bogle, one of our brilliant creative leads, I think has had as big an impact on me outside of work as inside work, is Super Communicators by Charles Duhigg. I think you'd say his name, Duhigg. It's basically all about how to have deep and more meaningful conversations in every area of your life. And within work, especially with what we do, being able to talk and get to the nub of issues and what's really motivating somebody and scaring them is obviously really, really important, and you know what drives them, what excites them. But the really beautiful part of the book is it also arms you with just how to talk to people when they're going through really difficult parts of life, tragedy, loss, bereavement. And there's a particularly powerful part of the book that I know a couple of people in the agency in their personal lives have just found just really comforting, like how bad we are culturally when people die and people are very uncomfortable and they'll say the courteous things like, I'm so sorry for your loss. But what you really want somebody to do in that moment is talk to you about the person that you loved that's not here anymore. And there's beautiful advice on, you know, saying things like, who was that person to you? And, you know, what were they like? Tell me some of your happiest memories of being with them. And it can feel a bit counterintuitive because you're asking that person to step into sadness, but you're actually allowing that person the space to express their grief and express their love. And tools like that, that the book talks through about, you know, the fundamental realities of some of the really hard shit that happens in life and how to have better conversations with the people that you love and care about to show them that you love them. Yeah, it's quite a life-changing, profound book. I would really recommend it.
Yeah, fantastic. And I think for the second episode running, there's three books there that haven't come up before, and that's just increasingly rare.
Hey!
Amazing. And then lastly, then we dedicate every episode to someone and we bestow or hospital pass that honour, depending on your view, to our guests who have to give their reason why. So would you kindly dedicate this episode?
We would love to. Yeah. This was quite a hard one for us because you asked us to think about people that have had like a big impact in our careers, of which we've been so lucky, both of us, to have many. And we work with just incredible people. I think that somebody who has changed both of our lives quite profoundly in a professional capacity is Dan Watts, our Chief Creative Officer. Dan is really, he is one of the core reasons why our humble philosophy works so well and so powerfully. Dan and Tim, one of our other ECDs, have just always run this business not trying to make anybody fear them or not trying to create an elite environment to get to brilliant creativity. They are a living and breathing example. And Dan is this every single day of the fact that creative excellence isn't about getting people to revere you. It's just about being a very kind person that wants to get in the trenches and help people have a lot of fun. And Dan is one of those creative leaders who is just unbelievably kind, just incredibly accountable. And I think from an account person perspective, if Harriet and I put our kind of formal discipline hats on, Dan has never made it feel like our job to manage problems away from him. To our conversation earlier on about problems, he is like get in a room with me, let's figure it out together. And yeah, he's just an unbelievably brilliant and completely unassuming, kind human being, and makes our jobs a joy. So yeah, Dan, if you've got this far in the episode and are listening, darling, thank you for all that you do for us. We just feel very, very lucky to work with somebody like Dan, because the people that he and the rest of the management team, being, you know, like Dan is in that way, the people you attract are then of that ilk. And it means that if we do ever get people that come in and, you know, maybe the humble philosophy feels a bit kumbaya and dippy lula to them, they kind of self-exit quite quickly, to be honest. Because if you're somebody that is there for themselves and for their own ego, you find us quite an irritating culture. And I think if our creative figurehead didn't live and breathe that, it wouldn't be true of our culture in the way that it is with Dan.
Love you, Dan.
That's incredible. Do you know what? I've actually genuinely heard rumours about Dan. So I'm delighted to hear that they're all true. Yeah.
No ego whatsoever.
Fantastic. Well, this episode is very proudly dedicated to Dan Watts. No. Fantastic. So everyone listening, we're going to list everything we've discussed. We've got Cork Dork, 4,000 Weeks, Super Communicators. We'll, of course, link to Pablo. I'm going to dig out everything I can on Pablo Living Wage, the UVUC. How else can our listeners get more Harriet and Hannah?
LinkedIn. We're both on LinkedIn. Or email us. So hannah.penn@pablolondon.com or harriet.knight@pablolondon.com. First name dot last name at pablolondon.com, basically.
Amazing. Well, this has been fantastic. Thank you so much for talking so much sense about everything from commercial creativity to culture, purpose, legacy, not admitting who was good cop and bad cop. But honestly,
I'm still going with the answer.
No, well, I think that might mean you're bad cop if you don't know.
Yeah,
but it's been a real pleasure and I've enjoyed this even more than I knew I would.
Oh, thank you so much for having us.
And, yeah, it's such a pleasure.
It's such an honour and a privilege to be NOS. So thank you.
No, not at all. And finally, thank you to everyone listening. If you've enjoyed the episode, please do share and review the pod. Keep your questions and guest requests coming in. To get in touch, it's easy to find Gasp online or email The Mouthful. That is calltoaction@gasp.agency.
To action, I can't get no call to action, but I try, and I try, and I try, and I try. Yeah, hey, hey.